Civilization, where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
Sometimes the hardest thing with conspiracy research is getting ideas through to people who have got a rigid thought process going on inside their head. They're not happy, they're not open to new ideas, they're not really prepared to listen to your argument. And recently, Peter and I had an experience of that nature. We don't really need to go into detail about what happened because it's the age-old story, I think, of meeting people who've got a preconceived idea in their head of conspiracy research and they think they've got all the answers. Peter, would you say that this is something that is one of the biggest challenges, I think, when you're trying to get information through to people? They've got closed minds and sometimes they're just not prepared to listen to you.
Yes, I think it is, Martin. You've got to avoid lecturing them, of course, and we could all fall into that trap.
Yeah.
But sometimes you don't know in a situation always the way it's going to go. I mean, you can be in a group where you think it's quite open to new ideas, discussion, and you bring in an idea that you think is going to be accepted or at least debated in a way that could be at least make an interesting conversation that you can have in a civil way.
Yeah.
And then it turns against you in some way and you end up being a bit either made fun of or ostracised or called a bit of a crank or even borderline hostility in some instances.
Yeah.
I've had this happen a number of times in various groups. I'm not going to mention specific groups or places in any of this, but I don't mind slightly paraphrasing some of the incidents perhaps.
Sure, yeah. Well, absolutely. It's something I think we all encounter. I mean, even if you're not necessarily into particularly controversial or outlandish theories, you're going to encounter resistance because people, there's a certain mentality out there, and not everyone is part of this, obviously, but there's a certain, I think, and certainly I've noticed it's with the kind of baby boomer generation, people, I guess, sort of probably in their 50s, that sort of age at the moment. And particularly if you're younger than they are, say 20 years or not even that, say 10 years younger, they feel like they have to lecture to you. And it's very difficult to get them to listen to your perspective because to them, you're just the lad or whatever, however they want to describe it in their head. But it's sometimes those people who are, I think saying that they're the enemy is a bit far, but they're kind of like, as David Icke would say, they're the gatekeepers. And these are people who have got their mortgage all paid off, they're property owners, they've got a little bit of a stake in society. And for that reason, I think sometimes they feel like your theories and the research that you're doing is a threat to their way of life.
Yeah, I mean, there's a phrase called comfort zone, where someone's in a comfort zone and they can't be in their lifestyle or financially or intellectually or culturally. And it means not wanting to really take on challenging things or things that make you feel a bit uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Hence the word comfort zone, literally, you know. And when I've sometimes brought things up in groups where, you know, what's often happened is that I haven't even thought there would be a problem bringing up a subject. The classic one is 9/11. Another one, any conspiracy to do with the moon landings. Even crop circles in some circles, ha-ha. You just have to raise the subject. And it's like David Icke used to say about the old turquoise tracksuit, you know, a comedian only had to come on and say his name to get a cheap laugh. And you say this in some groups. You might meet in a room somewhere for a meeting or just in a pub with a group that you meet up with and you just mention one of these subjects in the conversation and it's it can unexpectedly cause an upset.
Yeah.
Or some sort of reaction that you don't expect and you can find yourself suddenly thinking, well, hold on, I came out for a nice evening out and you're all talking about football teams and different things in a very opinionated manner, even a heated manner, and it seems part of a certain blokish banter that you can sort of do that about some subjects and almost get quite worked up about things. which are acceptable to get worked up about. But then you bring in one of these other subjects and sort of bring it on, like playing a joker almost, to bring it into the conversation, thinking, oh, this would be a different angle, or this would liven things up a bit. And suddenly, it's not that it'll even liven things up. It kind of freezes the conversation and it's thrown back at you. It changes the mood in the room to being unpleasant. And this has happened to me, as I said, on a number of occasions, in situations where the people I've been speaking to have been quite liberal and quite, you'd think, laid-back, maybe left-wing. You'd think they'd be open to ideas. I found often people who are left-wing and liberal, and it's a strange meaning to the word liberal, really. It's a word that's bandied around a lot. But I used to think it meant accepting different ideas, but it seems to be accepting certain ideas that are acceptable to accept. So in a way, left-wing seems to sometimes say, you will believe this. Liberal kind of says, you can believe this. You're free to believe this. But the menu of options is quite limited. And as I said, the classic conspiracy theories or research that I've mentioned, three obvious examples of things that can, you know, have to ruin your cocktail party, you know, if you want to get rid of your guests. Yeah. Bring these subjects up and you may clear the room. Hopefully, when you don't clear the room, you get some good friends. I mean, researchers like David Icke and Ian R. Crane, for example, are both in their 50s and are very open to things. And they're, you know, they're kind of awakened, aren't they? So they're it's very different from somebody maybe a classic baby boomer who, the term baby boomer comes from post-Second World War, and it's the population explosion because of the war and the rationing, particularly in the UK, but other countries too. They had a lot of worse things with invasions and stuff. You know, they were kind of slightly pampered. They were given the kind of, you know, the kind of post-war prosperity, building a new society, building suburbia in America, having televisions. Then the 60s came along, and that was a kind of flower power type thing.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes they seem almost childlike to me. And I think that's something that people of younger generations, I think they sometimes perceive that because they don't have the same level of worry that people growing up nowadays seem to have. And I think there's that danger of people saying, well, nowadays, yeah, sure, there's problems, but there always were problems, like in the Cold War. They always talk about the Cold War and say, we were really worried during the Cold War that there was going to be a nuclear Armageddon and the Russians were going to hit us with ICBMs and all this business. And yeah, sure, I mean, they had to go through a lot of fear-mongering, and I'm sure that there was a genuine fear there amongst certain people. But at the same time, property was dirt cheap from...
Relatively, from
what I know of that period. And I think the basic fundamentals were kind of there. I mean, I guess it's easy to say all this because I wasn't around at the time, but I think the impression I get is that the stresses of modern day society weren't necessarily there. I mean, they people had to sort of strive to earn their bread, so to speak, and perhaps there was a lack of technology and therefore life was tougher for that reason, sure, but perhaps there's a certain level of stress that they didn't have, and it's kind of a sort of streetwise element that perhaps they didn't need to have. And nowadays people, I think it's because we live in a globalised society, people are kind of having to sort of be aware of a lot more in order to make sense of the world that they're living in. Because back then, I think if you kind of accepted the mainstream view of society, and let's face it, you would have had to have been pretty far out not to, because we didn't have things like the internet in those days to sort of really get people aware of sort of certain theories. But they didn't necessarily have to sort of be living in a complex world where there was everything was multifaceted, and you had to always wonder if a politician had a secret agenda and all this kind of thing. And nowadays, and I think certainly in the last 5 years, people are having to sort of continuously think a little bit deeper about what's going on in the news, because
is there any sign that they're all doing that? You said they should do if they want to really understand what's going on.
Well, I'm not so sure that they do, but the impression that I get is that they're very content with just reading the Daily Mail and just watching BBC News in the UK, which is just your mainstream run of the mill news programme. It's a bit like CNN, I guess, and that's it. But sometimes you're trying to say to them, look, there's this new technology out now called the internet, and you can actually get hold of information without having to rely on that box in the living room. And it's trying to get them to accept that and get them into the habit of starting to sort of question mainstream media. And this is the problem I have, is that I find it extremely frustrating when you're talking to people of a certain generation and that they're just closed-minded to this stuff, because I think perhaps they fear it because they don't fully understand it. I mean, there could be an element of that. But also, I just think it's because they perceive you as somebody who is, it's not their place. It's not your place to be telling them about this stuff because they're older, and therefore they know best. It kind of goes back to that.
I don't personally want to bang on the age thing quite so much. I can see there's a baby boomer generation that you can see that in, but like I said, not everyone's like that in that generation. It can be a trait, certainly when someone has had a career that the money they got could buy them a property, maybe 3 times the salary is the mortgage to get a flat or a house, this sort of thing. And they can have some money saved up and get all their health care very, very well. We've still got a national health service in Britain, but it's always being attacked. But in those days, there was a kind of post-war consensus, is what it's called, that these things were kind of what you wanted to do, give everyone an affordable home. And build council houses for those who couldn't buy them, have tenancies that were fairly priced for rental accommodation in the private sector. And this is what you would have. But what happened is, in the 80s, it started to break down. Obviously, there was a lot of ups and downs with unions and stuff, and we can argue whether that was manipulated. But when Margaret Thatcher's government came in, the markets were let rip on the more the 80s style, more the yuppie agenda, and that started to change some of those ideas a little bit. You can make a lot more money, but more than maybe you needed to make. But unfortunately, that put the property prices up hugely. And then when it crashed in the early 1990s, I thought things were going to get more sane again. And it seemed like they were. There was a kind of mini awakening in the 1990s, which is actually when we started the Information as a magazine. But again, the millennium came up, and then things got hyped up again. Then right up to 2008, again it crashed. I'm hoping maybe some sense is going to come again. We're just edging now into maybe the beginnings of another rising up in the cycle. So there's this economic boom and bust that's gone on, in my knowledge, since the mid-70s that I can remember. I mean, obviously I don't go back much before that, but certainly you go back to the mid-80s and you can see what happened since then. But with younger people, I would say I've had just as many difficult experiences with them, certainly when their campaigners or political or in environmental organisations. Very often they can be just as dogged as those who may just be not interested in politics or campaigning, who are leading what you might call a mainstream existence, which is maybe not ever being involved with anything, but yeah, they take the news from different sources. Even mainstream media, it does have information that you get, but it will just give it from a certain angle. And some things, yeah, we can say are very, very wrong about it, but it will give you, a stopped clock is right twice a day, as they say. You will get a good thing in the Daily Mail about fluoride in the water or something like that. but there'll be other things in there that aren't so good. And you have to be quite discerning to look at these things and compare them with other sources. In terms of the internet, of course, mainstream does have big sites on the internet too. So you can go on the internet and still see the Daily Mail and the BBC and stuff. You would have to be prepared to look a bit deeper and find your InfoWars and your, you know, Vinnie Eastwoods and the information, of course, like this channel. But if you don't go and find things like this, you're not going to be aware of them. Often once you are aware of them, you start going to them more and more. I mean, I didn't really listen to audio off the internet until I started listening to a tiny bit of InfoWars. And then once I've heard of Alan Watt, I started to get some of those. And then once you start to realise how easy it is to download audio, you keep doing it every week, get a few hours of stuff to listen to, and then you start realising that's a whole different world of effectively radio that's out there that you wouldn't get just by putting on Radio 4. So I think once, you know, maybe they just haven't clicked sometimes that there really is all this stuff out there that they're to get into.
Well, it's the older
you get the Radio Times, which is a television listings magazine in Britain. It started in the 30s, so it only had radio programmes in it. And you get it now, and it's got all the channels in it, cable, satellite. They're not even all the channels that are on the TV, you know. We're like America was. We used to joke about America, like 500 channels are rubbish. But we're like that in Britain now. You can put the thing on, you've got everything you want on there, so you don't even really need to look at anything. And when they try to put a channel on, like the Enigma channel, doing alternative stuff, they charge so much money. I don't know, with the People's Voice channel that David Icke's running, I mean, they were having a few problems the other week and they were taken off the air for a while. I don't know what's happening there. But it's very hard to fund these alternative things to you know, compete with what is there and the very loud offers that those channels have and the advertising they have, which means that you're going to always get that stuff thrown at you. You have to go looking for the alternative stuff. A great deal. I mean, even something as big as InfoWars, unless you really search on the internet for that type of stuff, you're not going to find it. You're not going to go to Google and find it advertised on the top of Google or Yahoo or something. They're not going to promote it, you know, they're going to try and bury it, really.
Yeah, and a lot of it is just being aware of the right websites and the right sources to go to. But yeah, I agree. I mean, it's just like you say, that the problem is getting people who are closed-minded to give alternative sources a chance, and they don't tend to even want to give them a go.
Well, I think there's something which I don't know whether we can think of a name of it, or a name for it, but it's a kind of defensive mechanism, which I think comes with mainstream culture. It seems to, and I've seen it happen several times, so I know it exists. It's a way of defending yourself very quickly against, like I said, about moments that get borderline hostile in meetings where certain issues have been raised. I kind of think, well, why are they getting so annoyed? All I've done is say, oh, 9/11, you never know, someone might have used an energy weapon or something like that. I might as well have gone in and said some insulting swear words or something and had a go at someone. But the reaction I get is raised something like that from a normal conversation, not just, oh, that's a bit of a silly thing to say, Peter. Like, innocently, oh, you're not one of them, are you? You know what I mean? You're one of those. I mean, this happened to me a while ago, but I won't go into the details, but it's happened many times in different contexts. I've had many moments where it hasn't happened, where I have opened some minds. I mean, there's a technique called seeding, I think. We just, you mention these things, because even if you get a bad reaction, at least they know of the subject. No one ever said 9/11 was an inside job. Yeah, someone could say, well, a load of rubbish, I don't believe that. But at least they know of that possibility. Then if they ever hear it again, it maybe settles a bit more. At least they know you weren't the only person who thought it. And the same with all these ideas. The more they're mentioned, at least they all know that they exist as ideas. A lot of it is just unfamiliarity with the ideas. But this reflex action I just mentioned, when someone get something that comes to them, it's right into their comfort zone, and they instantly snap into a kind of either anger or an insult or a quite nasty remark or mood back or a very dismissive approach. Not just a normal conversational thing like, I don't know about that, tell us a bit more, I don't believe that, but it's an interesting theory. Kind of not sceptical, it's a kind of hostile reaction, and I think it's conditioned in some way.
It's almost the way the media mock
things. They get someone on the program and then they slightly mock them, like when Dave and I used to go on the show, and they'd slightly wind him up. You know, they invite you on a program and then they kind of always play that, oh, you're a bit of a crank, but you're funny, you're a bit of an eccentric, get you on there. And I think some of that must be conditioning the response, but I still can't quite pin down why this very hostile response happens. And
it's just as an idea, but I mean, part of our brain, I think they call it the reptilian section or something along those lines. But
yeah.
it is that part of our brain that is very much about routine, and change. Any change is potentially dangerous and is perceived as a threat. So it's like if you're people, if they have a rigid thought process, and there's been some study, I think I read it in an Ike book a few years ago. Ike was referencing a scientific paper that talks a little bit about how people's thoughts and beliefs can literally solidify. So it becomes an ingrained opinion that you can't really shift it. Almost physically, it's solidified inside of the brain.
Yeah. I have one idea about that. I felt may have occurred to somebody I know, I won't mention, but it happens many times. I think what sometimes happens is when someone's young, if they're having a good time and they formulate their opinions at that age, the opinions they've got become associated with a happy time. And so if 20 years later you come in and say it's different, they take it as an insult to them or a threat to them, because what they're really doing is associating that opinion with that time.
Yeah.
And someone I know who, I think they formulated their opinions very much in the early 80s when they were sort of starting their career, and they're very successful in that career. And I think that they actually were quite left wing, but they got into something in the entertainment business. They did well, and they were like left wing, and they were anti Margaret Thatcher at the time, thinking, oh, Thatcher, it's terrible that she's in power. And they kind of like to hate her sort of thing. And the trouble is that what happens is that they associate that with that period when they were becoming well known, doing successful work. So years later, I come along and just mildly say, well, maybe Margaret Thatcher is just a front figure. Maybe, you know, I don't exactly love her, but I could say, you know, she was just a bit of a front for the real players behind the scenes. But they were so in love with saying, oh, Thatcher, she's terrible, bash Thatcher, and this sort of thing, whatever they said. I don't know what they actually said, but their views were kind of that anti-Thatch, out with Maggie, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
If you say to them now that opinion was always wrong, it was delusional, it's mixed in their minds with a period of time in which they were doing well in other areas, and it's like ruining their memory of themselves, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean, and I guess also it even goes one step further, and people start to identify their sense of self with a certain movement or a certain belief system that they hold it dear to them, and it could be religion, it doesn't have to be politics. But the problem is that they associate with that, and they link it to their sense of self, and therefore it's like a personal affront if you say to them, well, there is this line of research that suggests this as opposed to what you're saying, etc. And they don't take that in the way it's intended. They take it as an attack on them as an individual, which is very dangerous.
That's right. You know, certainly the climate change issue is one of the ones that's caused the most upsets.
Yeah.
I think it's been very carefully engineered as an idea that it's man-made by CO2. And I think it's been wrapped up in a certain cosy, sort of nice, friendly package, which can involve going on nice parades, and you went on one back in 2009 with me when we went along as observers, but we had a nice day in London, where you had lots of nice costumes and banners, and everyone dresses up in funny outfits, and you walk through London, and we all end up in the pub afterwards, and you think it's a nice day out.
I can't believe that was 4 years ago.
Yes, that's right. So it's a nice day out, and it's all climate change. So you associate it with something nice, climate change, it's man-made, but we have a nice parade, we wave flags. So nice day out, climate, you know, it's like Pavlov's dog, or not Pavlov's dog, it's some experiment. I may have got the scientists wrong, but they're associated with, you know, you give the dog food and you ring a bell. Give a dog food, ring a bell. Next time you ring a bell, the dog comes. There's no food, but it's still salivating. And what you do, you associate in the mind the you know, the nice thing and the thing that goes with it. But then you could give the dog poison, ring a bell, the dog comes for the poison, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think what happens with the climate thing, they associate nice, fun parades started with us. Skeptics is old men on telly going, well, we're deniers. It's, you know, someone like, you know, Nigel Lawson, he used to be a Tory chancellor. Oh, do you want to side with him, or do you want to side with the funky characters with the drums and stuff, walking along in London and having a nice parade, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, fluffy little pictures of the earth and things like that. They look nice, and you want to side with that. It's all nice and fluffy, and it's good fun. And I was into that movement for a while, and I did believe it for a while. And I was sitting on the fence, which was still fair enough, because it might have been true. It was only when I discovered, really, that organisations were wholly going over to this view and not taking other views on board, that I became alarmed, because I could see that it was taking over the movement. And subsequently, we know a lot more about it, and we could do a whole episode on this, maybe sometime. But needless to say, you know, those who got fixated in the movement, they became themselves with climate change activists, and they associate that with themselves. So if you then go back to 10 years later and say, that was never the right thing to do, it was always wrong, I can live with myself doing it, because I go, it was fun at the time. With what I knew at the time, it was fine. But I was on the journey then, because before that, I hadn't done that activism. So at least when I did it, I cared enough to do it. But the difference was, I saw that as part of a journey. When I did then realise it was not wrong to have done it, but it was based on erroneous data or an erroneous campaign that was wrongly founded or wrongly controlled. I moved on. I didn't blame myself for doing it. It was just campaigning for something which I now maybe disagree with in the way that we did it. But I can forgive my younger self for doing it. Well, what they won't do is move on and forgive their younger self for doing it. See, if they could take on board, like the older generation you're talking about, if they could sort of say, yeah, we were right to do, go along with this because it was the way we were in our age, and that was fair enough. But you are different because you're in a different situation. What they're trying to do is impose on you the paradigm that they once had, and they can't understand that it's a different situation now. They don't understand that things are always moving on. Even their little bubble of baby boom, boomerdom, if that's a word, was post-war. Well, 10 or 20 years before that, you know, their parents were living through very hard times, being bombed and in the Second World War, or fighting in the Second World War, or in the 1930s and 20s, where, okay, there was boom and bust then, but, you know, there was terrible poverty. And then the First World War before that, you know, so, and that would be another generation, great grandparents maybe, of us, or their grandparents. And then, you know what I mean, there's these cycles of what they somehow seem to happen, particularly with the baby boom, because that's when all the mass technology and mass media came in. And I think at some point, a lot of it's based on the technocratic agenda and the sort of thing that Alan Watt talks about, Carl Bernays and this sort of thing, Edward Bernays and Carl Quigley, they wrote these books about how society would be engineered and set up in a certain way.
Yeah.
And a lot of that stuff was instigated after the Second World War. It was planned that way to come in after the Second World War, this type of consumer society, to get everyone hooked on mass consumption so that they're fully under control of the system. And once you get them under control, then you can say, well, we can pull the rug out at any time because we are running this system. So you've really got to keep being a slave, you know, and assume it's too frightening to realise that truth. if they could somehow mentally, you know, David Icke has done, he's someone who's a baby boomer, he was able to say, I was right to be a goalie, I was right to work for the BBC, I now realise what the BBC is. You know, you've got characters like Savile running around there back in that day and things like that. But he's moved on. He doesn't blame himself for what he used to do. He said, that was a stage in my life, but now I can see it differently and move on. And that's how you do it. You don't blame yourself for having had that period. You must move on, though, but still retain the memory of it and the forgiveness to yourself that you did it. I think what happens with, like I said, a lot of people who can't move on, they've got a fixed idea of what they are and their self that totally associates with one thing, one aspect. And whether it's football or something like that, or the climate change thing I just mentioned, or some sort of job or a hobby of some sort, they've got fixated on. And the minute that's wobbled, they can't understand it never was the whole of their being. It's a very good part of their being. There's nothing wrong with it. But he must see it as a part, not the whole.
Yeah.
See what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I think that's it, and that's the problem. People, it's so easy to do in life, and can completely understand how it happens. But I think people focus on a narrow band of information, and it becomes their world and their. I think Robert Anton Wilson used to describe it as like a reality tunnel. So it's like somebody's reality is that view, that belief, and that stream of information. And they don't see a bigger picture, that they refuse to see it, or they just can't see a bigger picture outside of that belief system. So it's things like, I guess you could describe something like having an obsession with, like you say, global warming or climate change. You could spend your whole life now worrying and fretting about that. Is it something that we should be concerned about, or isn't it, etc.?
Well, see, that wouldn't worry me, Martin, if that's what they were doing. The trouble is, when I brought up the idea that there might be other reasons, or there might be groups behind it controlling the weather with other methods and or whatever other conspiracy you want to bring in. So I thought they would find that interesting because they're interested in climate issues. But they don't. They actually reject it. They can't. They get hostile because, again, they're sticking to one idea of what it is. It's not the programming is what they stick to. It's not as if they're even interested in the subject. They don't go and read books about the weather and find out different stuff. You know, if they were genuinely interested in the subject, they would actually want to look at the different angles. And that's what's really disturbing, you know. I mean, you get a similar thing happens with science fiction fans, I found, and people who are into comics and that sort of thing. Is that, you know, you'd think, oh, they're into superheroes and spaceships, robots, things set in the future. You'd think they'd be very open to hearing, oh, the, you know, what a crop circle's about or something else like that. And you bring these subjects up, they get quite hostile. For some reason, they can't understand things might happen in the real life. You know, and some are different. There are some who will cross over, but some will get borderline unpleasant, and certainly treat you like you're, you know, maybe got a screw missing somewhere, for even thinking it could be things in real life. Yet they spend all their time looking at stories that are completely made up, and not only just looking at them, but analysing them deeply. You know, every version of Superman, or you know, every version of Doctor Who that's been done. What is one man? As Doctor Who better than another actor playing Doctor Who. You know, I think when Doctor Who is here now, he'd say, go and investigate chemtrails or something. There are things attacking you right now. You know, if their fictional character said it to them, they would believe it. But if it happens to them in real life, they can't get it. It's a completely bizarre thing that they're given a kind of ability to understand imagination in a fictional package that's given to them, but they can't apply it as a metaphor to other things. I think this is a lot of what the problem is. It's not having transferable skills or attitudes. Like we're talking about the climate thing, if they could then say, well, we're interested in that, means we're interested in science, okay, friends of the earth or whoever, give us a certain view, but why not go and look at the guy talking about chemtrails or something like that, give him a fair hearing, and then they don't have to believe it, but they could give him a fair hearing. The truth may lie somewhere in the middle, perhaps. But they are completely rejected from the start. And it's as if they don't at the package as it's given to them. And that word culture is one that is very telling. It's a kind of culture, a cult is something you follow rather irrationally. Culture isn't a petri dish. It grows, you know, scientists grow it, they control it. So I think a lot of what culture is exactly that. It's given to us, whether it's the mainstream media, TV, aspects of the internet.
Yeah.
It's given to us to keep us, yeah. You know, keep us entranced by its colours and its sounds, and it does keep us captivated, like a child looking at a spinning wheel or something like that with a spinning top or a toy. It's fascinating to watch, but quite hard to pull your eyes away from it, you know.
Yeah, well, Terence McKenna said...
you have to be able to pull back, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're saying about culture. I mean, I think Terence McKenna sort of sums it up nicely when he just said culture is not your friend. So, and it isn't, because for the very reasons that you're outlining now, I think. But I've got friends who are essentially masters of virtual realms. What I mean by that is that they're extremely intelligent people, but they apply almost all of that intelligence into virtual reality sort of games. So
right, yeah.
Online universes where they're, I mean, and the problem is that their real lives are a total mess, but they don't care about their real lives. I mean, their consciousness is kind of shifting into this virtual space, and they're more interested in the fantasy realm of a multiplayer game than they are in sort of doing what they need to do in their life to sort of advance themselves as an individual, because to them, the reality is kind of dull and uninspiring. And there's been a lot of analysis about this. I mean, that's why games like World of Warcraft and that are so popular. And it's because people are kind of, I think they're sort of disillusioned by life and by reality a lot of the time. And they don't, like you say, they don't apply their intelligence to understanding and identifying an enemy or like you say, chemtrails, and starting to sort of research why things are as they are. I think they just, unfortunately, they've been brainwashed by culture and by media it's kind of cool to be basically ignorant. And unfortunately, that is something that you see in television and in comedy shows nowadays. And it's kind of a bit weird and a bit geeky to be somebody who actually has knowledge about a particular subject that isn't to do with sports or science fiction or something that's media related. And I think Alex Jones talks about this quite a lot. I've heard it. It's a subject that he raises from time. You know, it's to do with people focusing on things that don't matter and sacrificing the stuff that does matter. And there's definitely some brainwashing involved in that, I think. And it's very powerful, whatever method that's being adopted to kind of do this to people. It's brutally effective, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's right. It's a big subject. I mean, the science fiction thing is a massive subject. Like I said, I would hope, and I think in some instances, it of course does open minds to certain ideas, where people can transfer those thoughts. And some authors who have been good at being activists or being aware of the real world and putting it into novels, for example, that do say something. I mean, J.G. Ballard, I think, was a very good example of someone who did understand reality and could write fiction that would make you think and apply it to the real world. He wrote a lot of stories that are very skewed realities. But he also wrote an autobiographical book about the Second World War when he was in a prisoner of war camp in the Far East. I'm not sure quite which country offhand. So with someone like that, you know, you can see a lot of intelligence going on there. If someone reads his stuff, you probably could have an interesting discussion with them. Some of the other science fiction is a bit more gung-ho, let's build a big rocket and go into space sort of thing. And it can lead to a kind of, not fascism, but almost a kind of righteous kind of, yeah, we can do this, science has got all the answers, so the mainstream must be right. You know, in a way, Star Trek, although I love the programme, the old series, I do dearly love it. It's highly entertaining. But I have to say, it is of that type of thing where it shows you a world that's fully realised and very enticing to go into, but it's all run by kind of vast amounts of technology and mankind somehow controlling the universe. And in a way, it's a metaphor for America and the American military. It's always the theory there, and Gene Roddenberry, I think, did have something to do with CIA at one point. But I think a lot of that, it appeals particularly the male kind of mentality to kind of get into these sort of things, because they're very much about militarism and bonding and that sort of thing. And it's very enticing, you know, it's given to you in an amazing way, and that they have little communicators that look like mobile phones, and hey, mobile phones come out, you know,
yeah,
years later, and they look like the things in the program, and you think, well, who designed it first? And if you said that to someone generally who's a Star Trek fan, they'll kind of go, oh, Star Trek's amazing, it predicted mobile phones. You said to them, well, actually, Gene Roddenberry worked for the CIA, and actually what may have happened is that they knew what was going to come out and put it in the program. The whole thing is a metaphor for your life now. They wouldn't like that, because, again, they want to believe Star Trek and out there in space, and we've got these aliens, and we're going to build all those big spaceships one day and go out there. They don't want to think that that's a metaphor for now. And actually, what the program might be telling you, if you really watched it, is be your own Captain Kirk. You know, walk down the road, and if you see an injustice, you don't be down, you step in and maybe do something about it. You know, the real metaphor in the program, the morals of it, are quite good. But fortunately, the program itself appeals to a certain kind of technocratic mindset that is there in particularly a lot of men. I have to say, it is with that type of program, it does appeal to that side of things. There's nothing wrong with that. Again, I like the program, but it has to be treated with caution. You know, like a lot of these things, it's trying to slightly push you a certain way. It doesn't say, well, how do they actually build these spaceships? Where do they mine all the metal from? You know, what kind of society is it really on Earth? Got all this going on, what sort of government and politics are on Earth to run this? It may be an outright new world order in order to have this society going on, you know. And it nudges you in the direction of thinking, well, yeah, if we had a global government, it'd be really good that we could build these giant spaceships, because you need a global government to do it, and then go off into space and have a federation now in space. It can be very believable. And back in the 70s, I used to really believe these things would happen. And quite soon, I mean, 2060 or something, I generally used to think, oh, yeah, I'll have gone to Mars by then, and maybe when I'm 100, I might get to another star or something like that. And the amount of stuff in the 70s about space that was on TV, it was unbelievable. I mean, you had the real-life stuff, Apollo, Soyuz, Shuttle later on. You had Doctor Who, Blake 7, loads of other programs on it. Tomorrow's World and James Burke specials, all talking about space, 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 the future. And it really was all the stuff that we've got now, but made to look a bit more clunkier and sci-fi looking. But I think you would buy into it all, and the space travel thing never really took off in the way they thought it might. But all the other things did, like the computers and the phones and different things. So a lot of people who grew up in that period, maybe baby boomers, maybe a little after the baby boomer generation, a lot of them are kind of got a lot of that in their system too, that they expected this future to come, so they're not suspicious of it in any way. And yeah, the internet has got a lot of stuff on it, like conspiracy type stuff to look at, alternative stuff, but it also has a lot of things which is being accused of doing, like you go on Facebook, yeah, it's a great tool, we've got a Facebook page for the information ourselves, but it's accused very often that Facebook is accessing your data and this sort of thing, and Google, exactly the same, you type a thing in, and yeah, it's a great service, it's free, but someone's giving it to you, it's not all costing no money, so someone must be looking at what you're doing and sending you advertising and stuff, it all works somehow. So again, a lot of the science fiction, like, again, they bought into the future, but they may be as suspicious when you undermine it by telling them there might be things about it that aren't good, you know?
Yeah, sure, yeah. And it doesn't help that all these virtual realms and sci-fi series and shows and books and stuff, they're also fully realised. So the problem with that is that it's great, but you can spend a lifetime researching about a science fiction program because you want to understand the history of all the characters and you want to understand the canon, and that's great and you can get really into it, but none of that really matters because it's not real.
Well, I have a phrase that any story, any film you watch, even any novel you read, really,
yeah,
just think this, these three words, always remember, it never happened.
Yeah.
Whatever it is you're looking at or even reading, maybe when you're reading sometimes it might be nearer the truth, but novels are obviously made up, you may have things that are based on truth that can be nearer. But any film you're watching, just remember this, out of the shot there's a guy with a microphone, there's a guy standing around, technicians, guys holding reflectors, light, there's a camera, obviously you're looking through the camera effectively. Then if you step back from the camera, you'd see the camera there, filming the actors, they're just talking for 10 seconds and they stop. They might then have lunch.
Well, yeah.
Then
yeah.
The camera moves around to another angle. None of what you're seeing is actually happening the way you see it, and the sound's put on afterwards anyway. Often there's backgrounds now that are dropped in afterwards. And they're actors anyway, of course. You might see Christian Bale in one film, you see Christian Bale in another film, you see somebody else. So you go, hold on, we're looking at a reality where the same person is somebody different, yet we accept it when we watch it as a reality. The point is, we play a game when we go into the cinema, we play a game of accepting that reality while we're in there, and that's great, you know. But no film that you watch is ever true. I mean, there's been a talk on the radio today, on Radio 4, about films that are based on real life, and there's been loads of them lately, you know, Rush, Captain Phillips, the Mandela Nelson Mandela biopic,
yeah.
12 Years a Slave, to a lesser degree, Inside Llewyn Davis, which isn't actually true, but it's kind of based on some true things. All these films, they're all very convincing when you watch them. You go into the world and it's like you're there. But remember, you're not actually watching the reality. You're watching a reconstruction of the reality. So they're great films to watch. You get a lot from them. Even in those things that are quite truthful, there are things that are different. It's never the reality as it actually was. It's a reconstruction of it. And then there are willful changes anyway in these films very often. There are things they put in that never happened, and just to make the story a bit more contracted, or in some cases to make it a bit more exciting. I mean, there's a film coming out next week. I can't remember. I think it's called Lone Survivor or something like that. I may have the title.
Yeah, it's about Mark Wahlberg's in it. Yeah, it's about the SEALs.
Yeah,
in Afghanistan.
It's a true story. A true story, they say, until you find out what's true and what isn't. And the whole battle at the end of the film never happened. The guy at tea came back.
Right.
The bit where he digs out a bullet, it never happened. He got wounded, but it wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
But they jacked it up.
Well, yeah.
You know, if someone could go to that guy, I'm seeing the reality of Afghanistan here. They're not. They're seeing a version of it. They're seeing a very well-made film that's probably great. But it isn't actually the reality.
No, particularly with film.
And around these things and, you know, look into it, someone could base their whole reality on all these fictions. I mean, another thing, an obvious example, is Coronation Street. You have a bizarre situation where, you know, we're not casting any aspersions on anyone here because it's a court case, but you have a fictional street in a fictional part of Manchester that's been going for 40 or 50 years. An actor in it playing Ken Barlow, who's a nice guy and sometimes has a few issues in the programme, but we like following his adventures. That exists in one reality. Another reality is the actor's in court for various allegations of rape and things like that. And there's a kind of weird reality where you watch Coronation Street, and maybe he's not in it at the moment, but that reality continues, yet the real man in a kind of real reality is in court. And it's a very strange situation, because people almost believe Coronation Street's real when they watch it. And, when one of the characters, the transsexual lady, Hayley, who herself is played by a woman anyway, so in real life isn't even a transsexual, but in the programme, she dies. Well, I saw things, send tributes in to Hayley, Grammar's Well Done, that was well acted. Or Hayley Dye, Send Tributes In. This is a fictional character. They'd already recorded the programme, you know, weeks ago. You know what I mean? It's a fictional reality. I mean, there was a thing, I think ages ago, it might have been in the Cell Block H, one of these sort of prison dramas. Again, where one of the characters was put in prison. And a national newspaper is actually saying, oh, we must free this character, you know. It was absolutely ridiculous. And write in, and not just, oh, put a silly story in, but write in and or sign a petition or whatever to free the character.
Yeah.
No, this is just an actor, an actress playing a character in the programme. But you see, people really believe these things. And if you think about something like the Tavistock Institute, it's been rumoured that they have put out ideas to put into these programmes, and something like Coronation Street, behavioural change, like how the families operate and how you react in situations. I mean, years and years ago, a friend of mine, Glenn Cork, used to say he didn't like EastEnders because at the time it was just non-stop arguing. And I think we've even put out this conversation on the information. We kind of discussed this, and at the time I think we poo-pooed the idea that that was a conspiracy. I mean, I think maybe it was. I think there's a certain sense of hostility. And for some reason, they put these ideas out, and it encourages a certain type of behaviour. And I think what we might think of sometimes that working class overly, a bit dumb, a bit opinionated, but I like my football and one of the lads have a pint down the Queen Vic or whatever. A lot of it is imitative. You know, someone doesn't, not every working class person is like that, but you never get in these programmes someone who's working class who lives in a room somewhere and just does nice artwork or something, and they're working class. If they're like that in the programme, they'd be rich and middle class. You know, they've always got certain ideas of what those sorts of person are, and I think it does create barriers to what you can be in society, you know, because again, it's the fictional borough of Walford in London. It doesn't exist. We know it doesn't exist. Look at the A to Z, it's not there. We play a game when we watch the programme. I don't watch it, but we play a game when we watch it that it's there. But it isn't there. Yet it's almost believed to be true.
Yeah.
And because it's television and it's bright, I mean, you know, it's colourful, and now it's high definition, it's even worse because it seems more tangibly real. The old programme didn't look quite like that. The TVs are smaller. Then they were black and white going back. Now they're colour, they're big, high definition, so they've got that in-your-face quality. They're so bright with the LCD screens in particular. They're so bright, or the LED screens, I mean. They're so bright, it's almost hard to not look at it. Like you go in a pub and you see these things, you always have to look away. I mean, there's a very good pub near me. There's a coal fire and there's a telly over the coal fire. You want to look at the coal fire, yet you keep looking up at the television. And it's the 24-hour news on there, and you see the scrolling headlines. And okay, I do look at it because it's interesting and useful, but I make sure I look at the coal fire most of the time because, you know, I want to be in a real environment, and the coal fire makes the pub seem nice. But the more these screens are everywhere, all well said about telly screens being everywhere, and I think this is what it is. It is kind of an Orwellian thing, but where Orwell got it a little wrong is that it was all very authoritarian in Orwell, and I think what happens is they mix it up more with the Aldous Huxley view of pleasure as well. So it's kind of friendly fascism. It's kind of in your face, but it gives you a little bit of something nice to look at as well, little adverts and stuff. You know, if you really did have Big Brother on the screen going, you must do this, you must do that, you might not do it. But if they put nice adverts in there with it, and he says it a bit more friendly, when you do, you get a celebrity on there or a film star to go, oh, that's a good thing to do. They endorse it, and then that message clicks, oh yeah, that film star who we like in the film that we saw is a good person, and they've endorsed it and said, do that. And then it reinforces, like we said earlier, about one thing that you like in your life reinforcing another thing that you do. It becomes reinforced, and so it clicks in your mind, and it literally programs you to do that. And that's why it's called a TV program, I think.
Yeah, and yeah, absolutely. But you're going back to what we were saying, I think we unfortunately live in a world where special effects and all of these post-production methods and just the slickness of the package that you get nowadays when you watch television or go to the cinema, it's all so good that if people who aren't necessarily capable of sometimes differentiating reality from from fiction.
And that goes back to what you said earlier about children, is that children can't tell the difference between fantasy and reality.
And the problem is because it's all so slick, it magnifies that whole problem of it seemingly being real, and they find it difficult to actually accept that it's not real. And there are, I'm sure there's people out there that when they go to the cinema and watch films, they don't have that intellectual sense of knowing that it's not real. Unfortunately, I think there may well be people out there now who, and I know it's crazy to think that it could be true, but I wouldn't be surprised if there are people actually out there who don't possess the level of intelligence to be able to actually differentiate between the idea that something is real and something is fictitious, in the sense that it has been put together and filmed in a studio. I think if you challenged them on it and explained to them, they would probably understand. But I think the point I'm making is sometimes it's on an unconscious level, they're not necessarily, sorry, a subconscious level, they're not necessarily thinking of it in terms of it not being real. They kind of are just accepting that it's an event that's happened. And certainly if they watch EastEnders, and mainstream media don't help. I mean, with EastEnders and that, you get these magazines and they talk about it as if it is a real story, and the families are real people, and you know what will happen to Grant next week.
Yes, I don't say that was a well written script, well performed.
Exactly.
They talk about it like it's an actual thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure that the people I'm talking about, if you reminded them of the fact that it wasn't real, yeah, okay, they probably would accept that, but you would have to trigger it. And
well, this is where we come back to Orwell, it's the phrase doublethink.
Yeah.
Which is the ability to hold two contradictory opinions at the same time.
Yes.
And I think this is what it is. They know it isn't real at a level, but they want to think it's real because they like it when they're watching it. So they'll defend the fact that it's sort of real. Think about it, the emotion is real. If you watch EastEnders and someone's screaming their head off and, oh, you ruined our Christmas, and they throw something at someone. Even you see it every year in EastEnders. I usually do see it occasionally. And, you know, the emotion is still real. It can still be quite disturbing to watch that, particularly if you sit through the whole episode and the character's quite nice and then they get yelled at the end and there's a twist at the end. You think, oh, my God, that's horrible. They're going to go to court or they're going to be in trouble or something. You're hooked on the little cliffhanger. The emotion can be quite real, you know, and seeing things like that, you know, it still gets in your head and has the same effect, almost as if it had happened. I mean, maybe not quite as much as if it happened in real life, but it still triggers those thoughts and emotions. It can be quite disturbing. A well-made book, I'm not knocking film and TV, nor are you, at their best, but even the really good stuff, it can be disturbing to watch a really well-made film. I mean, the absolute classic, of course, is The Shining, which is a very hard film to watch in some ways, and you can watch it in a lot of different ways, but there's real emotion there and upset. Just the family drama alone is disturbing, you know, and yet we know it's acted. Well, we think it's very realistic watching it, but yeah, we know it's put together by somebody, of course, but the point is you can still get a lot out of it. But the difference with that is that you have to think about what it means. It doesn't point you to an easy conclusion, like life's easy, everything's okay. You know, it's not a tragic end in some ways. In some ways it is. So you give them a mixed feelings, which you can then think about. The trouble with a lot of the mass culture is that it's very much pushing you into a response that you're meant to have. And it's not leaving that ambiguity there. That a really good filmmaker, a program maker, someone like Ken Loach, for example, or Mike Lee as well, would make a film, say, set in Britain or Britain working class areas, and it would be very ambivalent. There'd be characters who are a bit rough diamond types, but they'd have good sides to them. And it'd be realistic. It may not be over-dramatised, but it's kind of how things sort of are. But your EastEnders time programmes are continually firing off a ridiculous number of storylines that happen in a very small geographical area, which if it really happened in real life, this whole street would be put in a mental hospital, frankly, you know. It's a kind of hyped up version of reality, you know, but it gets mistaken for the real thing, you know. And I think advertising does a similar thing. Every time you have a car, it's driving on a big road and this sort of thing, and there's sunrise, and it's all wonderful, you know. Or hairspray, you're walking down the road, spray your hair, and the skyscrapers in the background, it's all, you know, glamorous. It's never like some glossy kind of car park somewhere, you know, and or, you know what I mean? It's always the best or the most obvious kind of version of something done really well and enticingly. So, like you said about sitcoms, again, I do love sitcoms. And I've got a bit more suspicious of them lately. And again, it's been said like the male character often in sitcom is made to be a bit of an idiot. And there's a kind of smarter woman in the household who puts him down a bit. And there's a bit of, again, a bit of that Tavistock Institute thing going on there, maybe. Maybe, you know, it's a controversial thing to say, but is that a kind of feminist issue or trying to push a feminist idea? Perhaps it is, you know, that the men are a bit dodgy and need to be put down. I don't know, but maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But something you do notice in a lot of programs where they'll do certain things and they put down certain characters, but other ones they'll never put down.
I agree, yeah, and I mean, I think it's a well-known fact that, you know, marketing, they target the women, so 80% of marketing is targeted at females because they are in control of the household, because men, for whatever reason, and I'm not saying it's a good or bad thing, but I think modern society, it's suppressing the masculine, and there seems to be, I mean, again, this is something that Alex Jones talks a lot about, how they're trying to feminize masculinity because I think they perceive true masculinity as a threat to the status quo, because if there ever was a situation where there had to be an actual battle against the globalists, the elite, whatever you want to call them, then that would be the force that would fight them. It would be the kind of traditional sense of masculinity, i.e. the breadwinner, if you like, or the kind of the hunter of the pack.
Yeah, and I think there's a kind of chivalric, if that's a way to say that word, masculine side, the kind of knight in armour, the good warrior type of thing, which again is suppressed nowadays. And,
yeah.
And the gentleman too is a good model as well, the English gentleman type, who's, it's not effeminate or weak, it's just polite.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But all these ideas are put to, oh no, it's a geeky character, or it's somebody silly, or if they're manly, it's made to seem ridiculous, like Star Trek, in a way they've got to have phasers and go into space. It's sidelined into a fantasy where it doesn't matter. Or, you know, even that war film I just mentioned that hasn't quite come out yet, Lone Survivor, don't give them a real story that will actually tell them what it's like to be in the Marines. Give them something that's a bit over the top, so they're kind of overwhelmed by that, and it kind of confuses reality. I can never do that because it's that tough, or maybe even that's so exciting I don't need to look further and read more about Afghanistan or other wars, because I've kind of got that in my head that this over the top story is so exciting I don't need to go and read other stories about it.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and like the Vietnam thing. So I think the Vietnam films, there's been a lot of good ones that haven't over glamorized things, and you know, obviously the Platoon, Deer Hunter, former Jacket, Apocalypse Now was more stylized perhaps, but it didn't glamorize it. It's a, you know, Heart of Darkness story, but all those films, they're all quite down at heel films you can watch, all gritty. There's a bit of humour in all of them, but you can watch them and then you could go off and read, you know, a real book about Vietnam, and it would actually add to your knowledge of it and give you the visual references to take when you're reading off the page. But I think other things sometimes they give you a bit of a false idea. And I think, yeah, the masculinity is very odd. I mean, they're always going on about LGBT and things like this. And again, all these things have got their place, but they're being up too much, and other things that you can never say. You know, if you say other things, you really are put down all the time. And there has to be a balance, and I think maybe before things were a bit too traditional, perhaps maybe it's deliberately like that in the past. Maybe they kept everything a bit too straight in the 50s or the 40s, kept everyone down a bit, because it was hard and times were lean and there was rationing and, you know, all men walked about in black jackets. And then you had other cults, like Teddy Boys, and that reacting against that, saying, no, we want to wear colourful clothes and stuff because we want to rebel a little bit. But then all these rebellions can be controlled as well. I suspect at some level society was overly constrained in the 40s and 50s into very lean amounts of very, very austere times, so that a lot of this stuff was unleashed later on, but it was let out too much. I mean, Alan Watts says in the 20s they were trying to do a lot of this stuff, and with the kind of swinging 20s, whatever they call it, and they had drugs and things like that, but it didn't quite work, and for various reasons, so they kind of reined it in a bit, and they're trying again now, or they have been since the 60s, to do it all again. And I think that's largely what's happening, and this time it seems to have fixed, and they're rolling on now further with it. Yeah, if the male thing was, if you talk about football, it's fine. If you get together and talk about global government, maybe bad.
Yeah.
Classic thing. You might get together and have serious ideas. Give everybody ideas that either diffuse them or confuse.
So that was a conversation I had earlier with Peter, and I think we covered some interesting ground there regarding why it is that some people have closed minds and what causes it. And we touched on various topics. So hope you enjoyed that. We're probably going to do more of these slightly more ad hoc style conversations, along with our usual more prepared episodic content, but we feel that sometimes it's a good idea to just have a conversation in a structured way and maybe touch on a bit of ground and go into a bit of detail and spend the time to actually explore a topic, because that's the great thing about the podcast format. You're not constrained to a specific time, and unlike radio where things have to be a bit more regimented and strict, we are able to explore an idea freely and take time to have an actual discussion. So stay tuned.
The information where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.